Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform. Welcome to the show, everyone. Today we've got Matthew Sinclair with us. Matthew is Partner and Vice President of Engineering for BCG Digital Ventures. Now, welcome to the show, Matthew. It's really good to have you join us. I can't believe that you've managed to squeeze out an hour of your day to do this. A guy is so busy, but yeah, thank you for coming on the show.
I just got back from a week's holiday, so there's a few gaps in my calendar this week.
Excellent. Right, so let's kick things off. I want to find out what service BCG provides and just a little bit about your role there just to start things off.
Okay. So look, let me start with the why. I'll talk about that a few times as we go through. So basically, if you look at the top businesses today, say 2020 onwards, it's a list of demand aggregators. Okay. And that's a big shift from say 10 or 15 years ago, or maybe even 30 years ago, when you looked at the top 10 biggest companies in the world, and they're all aggregators of supply, right, or distribution. Okay, and so there's been this big shift, right, over this time, and so the businesses that have made that shift from aggregation of supply and distribution, or monopolies over those things, or oligopolies, through to now what demand monopolies or demand oligopolies. So the best businesses that have been able to make that work are the ones that have been able to innovate, fail, learn, and respond to this really hyper-changing environment at really high velocity. However, many organizations, though, have these systemic barriers to innovation that limit their ability to change regardless of the velocity. Okay, so this is things like the inability to hire the best multidisciplinary digital practitioner. Inability to control what I call, it's not actually my original phrase, but I use it a lot, innovation antibodies, okay? And these innovation antibodies are things that organizations muster to sort of squash innovation in an organization. It's quite rational for organizations to do that because they don't want to change the status quo, right? And so, innovating against antibodies is actually a bit of a challenge. And so the inability to control those is something that really hampers businesses. And then the one thing that really stands out, though, is this sort of inability to manage high velocity experimentation. And to do that, you have to be able to learn, you have to be able to innovate, and really fundamentally, you've got to be able to appreciate failure.
Yeah.
Okay? You can't learn unless you fail. All right. And so, in order to get to this sort of high velocity innovation that you see in these demand aggregators that seem to own the world today, you've got to be able to create this high velocity experimentation, learning, innovation, and failure culture. Yeah. Got to improve the velocity with which new businesses can be created. And then, and importantly, though, sometimes this is forgotten a little bit in the innovation space, you've got to improve the velocity with which you can change your current offerings, right? So it's not all about new, it's about being dynamic and what you've already got as well. So if you hold that, and this is a bit of a roundabout way to answer your question, but if you hold that really dynamic picture of organizational change in your mind, then this is where DV comes in, right? So right. What we do is we allow organizations to access that kind of high velocity innovation necessary to make a genuine impact when things are ludicrously uncertain. So how do we do that, right? So there's four things that stand out. We've got some of, and I've been around for quite a while now, about 26 years working. We've got some of the best multidisciplinary digital practitioners that I've ever had the privilege to work with. I mean, I know everyone says that, but it's really a joy. We've got a track record of delivering innovative change, both inside and outside the corporate firewall. And I'll talk a little bit about that in a sec, because that's really important in how DV is changing. And we've got a proven end-to-end methodology, both for innovation and incubation, and growth. And then finally, we're prepared to put skin in the game. And so I think this is what differentiates DV a little bit from more traditional consulting businesses. We like to proudly state that we're not consultants, we're builders. And so we'll put skin in the game. So we'll make investments into these businesses that we're building. And sometimes you can't, because the client maybe doesn't want you to do that. They don't need your cash, but we will do it in things like putting skin in the game in terms of doing work at risk or saying we'll do this first phase and you only pay if it converts to the next phase, like those kinds of things, right? So we're really, really actively, we actively invest, if you like, in the work that we do.
Sounds amazing. Sounds amazing.
It's a fantastic place to work. I've been there now for 5.5 years, coming up for 6, and it's one of the longest places I've ever worked. So yeah, I love my job to death.
Yeah, I bet. And also, I wanted to touch upon this as well, because I've been doing some research on you, Matthew. I hope you don't mind a bit of internet stalking. Nothing incriminating, don't worry. But you've had a very prolific career history, to be honest. And, you know, I speak to a lot of leaders in technology, and first of all, I want to find out if you deliberately have kind of navigated your career in any way, or did it just kind of sort of happen?
That's one of those questions that you can really only answer in hindsight. You know, there's a period I would like, if I start in the middle, there's probably a period where I was really dicking around, and if I look back on it, I was a bit of a wantrepreneur. I sort of enjoyed the idea of it rather than having, you know, much more than I had any real idea what I was doing. But if I go to the start of my career, I took a couple of big risks early on, and that gave me a bit of a boost. Like I did this. I went to Singapore kind of on my own from a company in Sydney, but was put into a job in Singapore. Wow. Leading the building of this sort of tactical flight simulator thing that we were building for a contractor for the Singaporean government. And I was so out of my depth, right? Like just completely and utterly beyond you know, any measure, right? Of being out of my depth.
Really?
Did it, and I was there, and we had a few other folks and we sort of, you know, we busted our way through, and the biggest learning I got out of that was actually that, you know what, make an investment in yourself, take a risk, concentrate on things you do know rather than things you don't, and then, you know, it often works out for you. And I'm lucky, like we're lucky, people who work in tech, we're lucky most of the time what we do, it no one dies. Right.
Yeah.
And so if you take a risk and you fail, as long as you can handle the hit to the ego or integrate that, it's actually okay. Right. And then, so I think I realize this now, 30 years later or 25 years later, I realize this now. I got this, well, I call it failure fitness. Right. And it's super important, right, to the stuff I was talking about at the top there. Being fit and resilient to failure is fundamental to being, to being any good at all in anything to do with innovation. And I, without really planning it, you know, to your question about planning versus, you know, falling into it, I didn't really plan it, but I sort of accidentally did it. And then it gave me those lessons. And then the second thing that's really, really stood out for me is what I've learned this in hindsight. I learned this backwards, if you know what I mean. I was lucky enough for this to happen. And then I look back at it now and I went, I was really lucky for that to happen. And it's getting the opportunity to work with really good people.
Yeah.
In my head, I always prioritize people first and then the work. And what I've learned is if you can surround yourself with good people or get the privilege of working with people that are hopefully better than you, you know, that's what I always try and seek out, then everything else flows from that. Good people tend to do good work on average, right? And so you're around good people, and then you get the luxury of being involved in the best work as well. Okay. And then everything else follows. You know, most good engineers that I know, they don't really chase the money. Right, they chase the people and they chase the work, and then the smart ones know their value, and so it's not on the list, but it's not the top item on the list. And you know, when I'm talking to younger engineers, I try and get them to think like that, because a lot of them are motivated by their, you know, they're struggling artists in many ways. You know, their creative output is code. Okay, and so the best way to get the opportunity to build, have that artistic output is to be with good people who are doing good work.
Yeah. Absolutely. And you mentioned, you know, taking on failure, and, you know, there's a phrase that keeps on coming up in these podcasts, which is fail fast.
Yes.
And I just want to see what your opinion is on that, because, you know, you can fail fast so many times, but, you know, you have to learn from those failures ultimately.
Yeah.
What do you think of that phrase?
So it depends what you mean by fail. Right. So, so I think your intuition there is spot on. If you're constantly failing in a negative way, then it's probably time to do something different.
Mm.
But if you embrace failure, right, and you treat the VP of product, who's actually just left us to go to another startup, but the VP of product that used to work at DB Hinland and worked with him for the last few years, he had this great phrase, which is, there's no such thing as failure. There's only validated learning.
Yeah.
And I shamelessly stolen that from him, because I think it's a great phrase, but it's really true. So if your view of failure is that failure isn't, you know, if you're allergic to failure, then failing fast is going to be quite demotivating and disheartening. But if you've got this sort of failure fitness, right, you know, you're resilient to failure and you understand it and you go, okay, we failed, what went wrong? What are we going to do differently the next time? You know, so failing at something is not something to be ashamed of. It's Absolutely. Something to be proud of. Failing twice doing the same thing. Okay, now we're going to have a different conversation, right? But even that, you know, I tend to not look too poorly on it. I think as long as you are learning, you know, you may learn a different lesson the second time you fail at the same thing. So, you know, there's always opportunities to learn. As long as you have that, then fail fast makes a ton of sense.
Yeah, and also, you know, people work in different ways. Everyone's an individual. I mean, how do you work?
I think there's a very big difference between sort of deep work, right, and broad work, let's call it, right? I don't want to call it shallow because I don't want to be disparaging about it, but let's just call it deep work versus broad work, right? And so deep work is where I'm on the hook to actually make something. Now, as a software engineer, that would be code, but as a leader, it might be a narrative for whatever the next, you know, 12 months of the business is supposed to be like, right? It's still creative work and it's deep work and you need time away. I call it flywheel time. You know, this concept of flow. For me, I'm actually pretty rubbish at getting my flywheel spinning quickly. Right. But I would argue that it's got a reasonable amount of weight to it when it does spin. And so my day four productivity is like an order of magnitude better than my day one productivity. Right. But I've got to get to day four and it's a bit of a slow ramp up to get to day four, if you know what I mean. If it's something that's very, very deep to do, right? But then broad work is where you need people, you need feedback, you need to test your ideas, right? And so the first thing you've got to do is work out the difference between those two things, right? And I think, you know, people starting up, they don't get the difference. And they actually, you'll see that a lot of engineers will do this, they'll shun the broad work. Oh, I don't want to go to meetings. I don't like being interrupted, right? And then that just creates antagonism between folks who actually their job is, if you think about it, their job is actually broad work, right? So it's less true for leadership, but in that middle management area, and we can have a conversation about the merits of middle management, but which, you know, we can talk about. But there are a bunch of people whose job it is to sort of manage folks, and the bulk of their time is broad work, and that's lots of interruptions, lots of communication, lots of collaboration, lots of expectation management and stakeholder management and all these kind of things, right? So you know, as an engineer, at least if I can talk to the engineers in the audience, one of the things you need to learn is just understand that there's deep work and there's broad work, and that they both have their place and their value, and you're probably more likely to be comfortable in deep work, if, you know, if my experience with engineers is true, than you are in the broad work. But the two things are valid, and you know, they're just often done by two different people. I think that was the first part of your question. Second part, help remind me what the second part of the question was.
Oh my God. What was it now? It was, how do you work? How do you?
Yeah. So actually, I know I do remember. So what I want to point you to a couple of links, actually, because there's this distinction which Paul Graham, quite some years ago, wrote a thing called make a schedule versus manage a schedule. Make a schedule versus manage. So just Google that, Paul Graham. And it's one of these seminal articles. I mean, you know, there's people have different opinions of Paul Graham, but leave the human aside and just look at the essay. It's a brilliant essay because it actually sets out this distinction between people who make stuff and people who manage people making stuff.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
The world is basically built around the manager's schedule, which is why often makers feel so uncomfortable, right? Because the manager's schedule is short, you know, 15-minute interactions and lots of interruptions and all this sort of stuff and PowerPoint decks and whatnot. Whereas the maker's schedule is, leave me alone. I'm an artist. I'm doing deep work. All right. But what I saw recently, a guy who I have a ton of respect for called Pat Kua, K-U-A, he's another Aussie guy who's working in Berlin and now he's started out on his own. He's got his own website, patkua.com, I think. He wrote a post just recently called Makers versus Multipliers. Okay, and it's actually based on a book I'll tell you the name of the book. The book is called Multipliers Revised and Updated, How the Best Leaders Make Everyone Smart, by someone called Liz Wiseman, and I've not read that book. So it's in my list of things to read. However, the Pat Kua article on makers versus multipliers is fascinating because what it does is a really interesting sort of addition to the canon, if you like, of this conversation. It says you don't need to be a manager to be a multiplier. Okay. And so the distinction, the distinction between makers and multipliers, maker is someone who's directly responsible for something, you know, so that's typically the job of a senior engineer. You're a maker, you're sitting there, you're writing code, right? A multiplier's job is to get the best out of some group of people, Okay. And what I really like about what Pat talks about in his post is that you don't need to be a manager to be a multiplier. Right. Yeah. You can be a multiplier as a team lead, or, you know, as a good senior engineer, you can be mentoring other engineers. And so I really like that. I will take one minor issue with it. I think to be a leader, you do have to be a multiplier. Right. Yeah, I think the job, as you move up, certainly the distinction between management and leadership, I think the further up to leadership you go, your job becomes much more about multiplying the efforts of others than yourself. And you have to learn this. You have to learn this thing, which is, you know, as a creative person, you get this buzz from building stuff.
Okay. Yeah, absolutely.
You know yourself, right? You build something, you know, you get that endorphin rush that comes from having made something. And it can be physical, you know, could be making wood, you know, cabinetry or whatever, right? But you know, with what we do, it's all sort of, or, you know, it could be an author, right? Writing a book. But once you get into management and leadership, you have to turn off your brain a little bit. You have to turn that part of your brain off a little bit, and you have to reprogram it so that you get your endorphin response, not from making stuff, but from being responsible for people who are making stuff. And then the further up the food chain you go, unfortunately, you get more and more removed. And so you have to introduce new proxies to that endorphin. And it's a skill you have to learn. It took me way too long to learn it. Because what you do if you don't have this is you keep dipping back into individual contributor, right? Yeah. And the best individual contributor in the world is not necessarily the best manager. In fact, sometimes they're, you know, those two things don't coincide, right? So this idea of being a multiplier, if you want to grow your career, I think it's really interesting. I won't steal Pat's thunder. Go and read his blog post. It's, I don't know if you have show notes or whatever. You can have the links in the show notes for those.
Yeah, sure.
It's definitely worth a read.
As a leader in your industry, you've got more than two parts to this, but these are the two parts that I want to talk about, because you have to kind of spend a lot of time, you know, surveying your team, surveying the business and helping, you know, things run smoothly on a day-to-day level with different projects, et cetera, et cetera. But also you've got this other part of the business as a other part of your role as a leader to look beyond the business and see what's going on in technology and what further developments you can make. So I'm just really interested to find out how you juggle those two aspects of your role.
Okay, so interestingly, I wrote something on this exact topic a while back, and it's one of the things that I've written that's got the most attention. So let me just sort of come back to that briefly. So you've heard of, I think everyone's heard now of 20% time. Google did that. Since about 2015, I don't know if everyone knows this, but they repurposed the initiative to allow for, quotes, more focused innovation, which I wrote was probably coded corporate speak for something along the lines of, we kind of lost control of this initiative.
Right.
But you know, it definitely gave the impression of being successful while it was there. You know, things like Gmail and Maps and whatnot came out of 20% time. So, you know, you can hardly argue with its effectiveness. Mm. And then at DV, we have this thing called magic time. And I'm not a fan of the word, but I'll just go with the concept in a sec. And essentially magic time is, if you're on the beach or you're not otherwise engaged, you can pretty much do whatever you like. Right. And you know, as long as it's related to the business and you're not, you know, you're not starting an e-commerce store selling, you know, surfboards or something, right? You know, you can do something that works. And a couple of our internal initiatives and things have come out of that magic time. So it's definitely a thing. And so what I was like, with that sort of stuff in mind, I came up with this concept called four-thirds time.
Okay.
And particularly how it applies to leadership. And the idea here is that in most, if not all places, you have to divide your time up into approximately three chunks, I would argue, right? Rather than two, right? So the first one is doing the thing that your business is in business to do. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, profitably creating, innovating, delivering products and services to your customers, whatever it might be. Right. The second thing is doing the things that set the business up to be better in the future than it is today. Okay. So thinking ahead, strategic decisions, taking strategic actions, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
And then the third thing that everyone knows about is setting things up for people to be their best today that they can be and be better tomorrow. All right. And so they're the three main things that people think about when they think about what leaders have to do. Now in practice, three, particularly in sort of tech businesses, like human powered tech businesses, three almost always comes first, because it's the people that are doing the head work, right? That has to be done to get stuff done. And then both one and two, you can't do those unless three is done properly. Mm-hmm. All right. And to your question about what ratio, right? You can actually have a good conversation about the ratio of those three things. And I think there's probably an argument that the further up the food chain you go, the more focus goes to three, and the closer to the customer you are, the focus is closer to one, right? And then mm-hmm. there's a continuum in between those two things. But it's not until you get to senior leadership positions and you've divided your time up into these three things, and you realize that you have four things to do, not three, and hence the four thirds time, right? And this is one of the burdens of leadership, that if you divide 100% of your time up into 33% chunks, turns out you've got 33% extra stuff to do, which is this fourth third thing, which is leading. And leading is a discipline in and of itself, right? It doesn't just happen, right? You have to be conscious about it. You have to have mental models that help you understand what's going on. People are the most complicated things that we know of in the universe, really. Like, there really just isn't anything more complicated than people. And trying to lead people is really, really difficult. And if you go into it without some rigor, I think you can get into trouble, right? I had this this idea of art versus craft that comes into it. And so there is, you asked me a question about, is leadership innate or learned, right? And my answer to the question was going to be, can it be both, right? Yeah. And the reason I think that is because there's no doubt you will have found people through your career who just have a natural sort of leadership aspect.
Absolutely. Right?
And people listen to what they say, and they had speak with gravitas and these kind of things. But sometimes those people, and equally there's folks who just got no idea, right, about what they, but they can be fantastic individual contributors, right? And so there's a sort of weird, are there a set of skills that I could give to that person in the second category that would make them more like the person in the first category, all right? And I would argue, yes, there are. Right? I call them craft moves, right? If you ever have this distinction between art and craft, right? Yeah. If you go and look at a painting in an art gallery, what you see as a naive observer like I am, I'm not an art historian or an artist, but what I see is the art. I see the art on the wall. What I don't see, but I do because I thought about it, I do know exists, is the craft that went into producing that piece of art.
Absolutely.
Okay? And so whereas the art might be that last 20% of genius, the craft is the 20 years of learning how to stretch a piece of canvas into a frame, or mixing paint, or understanding how color works, these kind of things that, are not obvious to a naive observer of a piece of art. And I think leadership is similar in the sense that there is definitely an art, and that's gravitas and personality and, how someone holds themselves and these kind of things, but there's definitely craft as well, right? And so there's these craft moves that you can learn as a leader that can make you a better leader, right? And so that's why I think, it's definitely both, not one or the other.
Yeah, it's so interesting. And, if you were to boil down leadership into like the most distilled point of what makes a good leader, and I think a lot of people overlook this. I mean, what do you think about, how much does being likable come into leadership, really?
Likeability is a trap, I would say.
Right.
Right. And so I'm not suggesting that you should aim to not be likable, but I know myself that I've probably hampered the growth of myself and folks that I've putatively been leading on occasion because I've been striving for likability and not necessarily striving for growth.
Right.
And this is a tough lesson, a tough leadership lesson. There's a point in your career where you realize that you can't actually just be one of the folks anymore. You have to. And sometimes, and people, I'm like this. I make really sort of deep friendships. I have a deep friendship with a small number of people. That's just how I work. I'm not one of these sort of social butterfly kind of folks. There's hundreds of relationships. And then when you end up in a position where you're then leading those people, there is a moment where you have to pull yourself away a little bit from it in order to get it. Help them grow. And, and I didn't realize this, which is really interesting. I've had this happen to me twice in the last 5 or 6 years. The person has said to me, you didn't push me hard enough, right? Or how can you've stopped helping me grow. And like it's like, wow, that's like being hit in the hand with a hammer when someone says that to you, right? Particularly when someone who you are genuinely a friend of, right, as opposed to a colleague, right? And so there's a tricky one. So likability is a bit of a trap, right? I think these days I go about the work environment a little bit differently than I would have 10-15 years ago. And I'm very careful of not falling into that trap. Now, I do deep down personality, sort of get under my skin a bit. I just want everyone to like me. Right. I'm just that I get anxious if I think people aren't, if I'm offending people or whatever. That's not my mode of operation. So this is a tough one for me, right? To get that right as a leader. And I'm not entirely sure I've got the right balance, but that's a constant project that I'm working on. But I think you asked me like what makes a great leader. I think you're sort of hinting towards like break it down. And so I want to give you some new material. I've been working on a new blog post in the last couple of weeks, and it came out of, I want to give a hat tip to one of my my colleagues, one of my engineering directors, Paul Groves. We were having a one-on-one, and he used the word altitude, and it really stuck with me. And so what I've done is I've been sort of crafting this point into what I call three A's, right? And so if you ask me what makes a great leader, and I've got the everyone's got their little, you know, their little sort of mnemonic that they use, but this is what for me what I've been working on recently. So it's attitude, altitude, and agency, right? The three A's. So attitude is a leader's ability to plot the right direction. Okay. You know, that the organization should be traveling to achieve whatever its objectives might be. And they can be many and varied, right? So you know, if you think of a sort of from an aeronautical point of view, it's like which way are we heading, right? What's the attitude? Altitude, right, is how high you fly. Okay. And that's a leader's ability to find the right height with which to you know, sort of fly over the organizational landscape that balances this difference between leaning in to course correct and standing back to accelerate. Right. And that's one of these sort of pivot points that's really hard to learn as a leader. The altitude one is a really interesting question, because, you know, every engineer I've ever worked with says that they despise micromanagement. And right. And so that's when the leader gets the altitude wrong. They're too low. They're too close to the ground. Right. And then I tend to be the opposite. I'm not a micromanager. I tend to be the opposite, but I've had the opposite criticism, which is you're too far away. We've lost the why, right? We've lost the reason that we're here. You know, what's the right narrative? We don't know why we're doing what we're doing. All right. And so this altitude question then is really tough, right? That's a subtlety.
Yeah.
To get right. And then the last one is agency. And one of the biggest things that's for me that's come out of COVID is that people have felt this really profound loss of agency over what they do. And so I've really been doubling down on it recently. And agency, by my mind, is the ability of a leader to multiply the power of others so they can be their best, all right?
Yeah.
So why have we lost agency? Well, because the world sort of fell in on everyone and we couldn't even leave the house, right? And so what you found, I don't know if you've been following the sort of in this particular business that you're in, I imagine you have, but this thing called the Great Resignation. I don't know if across this. Yeah. So this is the idea that more than 40%, I think in The Economist was reported, it's more than 40% of people in white collar, you know, sort of office-y type jobs in the US have already or are considering leaving their current work.
Wow.
Right? And it's a mass resignation on a scale we really haven't seen. And the interesting thing is they're not going from job A to job B. They're going, I don't want to do this anymore.
Wow.
Right. I'm going to do something else. I'm going to become a yoga instructor. Or I'm going to go back to school. Be right, and so it's you get one of these things to Google, the Great Resignation. It's fascinating, but we've seen it, right? We've seen quite a bit of attrition, and what I would call regrettable attrition, right? We've seen folks go, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm going to go and do something else. And I've thought about it a lot, like what's going on, what's in people's heads, and it's this lack of agency. When you take away agency from smart people, they get very anxious and they want to change something because they've lost the ability to control their environment, so they look for something. What can they change? Well, one of the things they can change relatively easily as an engineer is you're not going to be out of a job, right? So you can pretty easily put yourself out there and get another job straight away, right? And so for me, those three things stand out as the sort of key ingredients of success, you know, being a successful leader: attitude, altitude, and agency. You know, just to summarize, our attitude is strategic direction, altitude is operational execution, and agency is multiplying others.
Wow. I'm kind of blown away by that, Matthew. It makes total sense though, doesn't it? You know?
Well, it sort of resonated with me. And I do have to thank Paul for his altitude comment because it triggered that whole discussion.
Yeah. I mean, in terms of like, you know, we were talking about Lex Fridman and, you know, other people, other leaders in technology before we started recording. Are there any leaders that inspire you? I mean, any in the public eye particularly, or, you know, any not even to do with technology, is there anyone that inspires you really?
Yeah, look, so there's an obvious one. There's an obvious couple here, right? When you ask a technologist who they're inspired by, and, you know, Steve Jobs and Elon Musk come up all the time. And I wanted to call them out because they absolutely do inspire me. And I use Steve Jobs quotes all the times, and I find what Musk's done, you know, just look at the catalogue of what the guy's done in the last 15 years. He's like, it's just mind blowing, right?
Yeah,
the guy is either from the future or he's Tony Stark, right? You know, who knows what's going on. Yeah. But, you know, by all reports, you wouldn't look to them for their interpersonal skills.
Yeah.
Right. So they you know, people who've known them directly find them to be very challenging. And so for me, I would look to them for their inspiration, for the things they've achieved, you know, to great jobs. They've both made massive dents in the universe, right? But I perhaps wouldn't look to them for some of the softer skills or you know, some of the other things they've done. And so I had a bit of a think about it because I really like the question. And I picked out three other ones, which I tried to sort of pull from very different dimensions, right?
Excellent. So
the first one is Kevin Kelly. I don't know if you know Kevin Kelly. He's the founder of Wired.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and he's an absolutely just a genius human and a wonderful human being. Done a bunch of stuff in conservation, written a bunch of books. You know, his book on inevitability was brilliant. Obviously, founded Wired, and the thing that stood out for me with Wired was I remember picking up Wired magazine I think it was just out of uni, so 93, 94, I think it first started, and I remember getting US copies because back in Australia, all the magazines were a certain size, but these US ones that you had to pay back then, you know, they were $20 or something, which is an insane amount of money, with this odd American magazine size, and they stood out. And I just remember, like, the whole internet for me, and well, it wasn't the internet to be fair, it was the web, but my whole sort of, oh my God, like, wow, like, was just blown away by that. And that experience, I just always go back to it. It's just really profoundly, you know, shifting to me to get me to where I am and what I wanted to do. And then I'm going to get a bit more prosaic and come back to ground level a bit, but there's a guy called Will Larson who, wrote a book a few years back now called An Elegant Puzzle. I'll put it up. I don't know if you can see that.
Hang on, wait. It's going to need to focus. I'm going to put it up 1 second. There we go. Excellent. Yeah, got it.
It's called An Elegant Puzzle, Systems of Engineering Management by Will Larson.
Cool.
And I've always, I fancy myself as a bit of a writer. I really enjoy writing. I don't know the quality of it. That's for others to judge, but I've always quite enjoyed doing it. And I always wanted to write a book on everything I knew about engineering and, you know, managing and leading engineers. And then I read this book and I went, damn, he has written the book that I wanted to write, and I no longer have to. I have to find a new topic now, because it's basically the perfect book. You know, like Messi leaving Barcelona, and they're gonna shelve number 10, right?
Yeah,
it's a bit like that. I feel a little bit like a book. It's like no one needs to write another book on engineering management. It's so good. And then the last one's a bit of an interesting one. So Jason Kotke, I don't know if you know him from Kotke.org.
No, if
not the first, then that he was there at the time when blogging was invented, right? So his blog, Kotke.org, goes right back to the beginning. And on his about page, he's got this, what is it? Kotke.org says, it covers the essential people, inventions, performances, and ideas that increase the collective adjacent possible of humanity.
Wow.
And it's just such a dense sentence.
Yeah.
It's such a brilliant thing. And he's just been doing Kotke.org for whatever. And, you know, one of the first paid link blog style blogs, but he does a bit of long form stuff as well. He's a brilliant and a really brilliant guy. Definitely Kotke.org, Kotke.org, definitely worth a look. And then at the end of all that, I thought, okay, what have I done here? And I look at this list and I'm drawn to iconoclasts, I think, because every one of these people is an iconoclast in one way or another. All right. And so, you know, I really respond to people who break the mold, prepared to go it alone, outside the norm. And I really respect that when people have the courage of their convictions and, you know, they want to do their own thing. I'm a huge fan of supporting that.
Excellent. And it seems, you know, through speaking to you today, Matthew, like you've learned a hell of a lot about leadership, and it can't all come from hands-on experience, although I imagine that's probably quite a big part of it. But I want to find out where you get your resources from. You mentioned a few books there, and, you know, where else do you learn about this?
That's a good question. So look, I read a lot. I'm super curious. Like often to my detriment, you know, sometimes I've been accused of derailing meetings because I've dived into some, you know, obtuse point about something that I'm curious for my identification. So, you know, I've kind of learned over the years to try and stop that. But I just read a lot. Pre-COVID, I had a bit of a commute, not long, bit of a commute into town. So 45 minutes on the train, I would just sit there and just trawl. I had a set of sites that I would go and have a look at on a regular basis. I also, one of the things that we didn't get to talk about, but sort of craft moves that I talk about was sort of journaling. And right. I spend quite a bit of time. I'm a massive Unix nerd from years ago, so I use Emacs, and I've got like literally thousands of text and markdown notes in Emacs. And so I got to be, every time I want to remember a link, I've got a links org file, you know, org mode file that I've stored my links in. So I've got way more than I could ever read. But if I ever do find an empty spot, I sort of, you know, sift through it. And then what I try and do is I do that to pull it out for blog posts and things. The best source though is talking to other people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's, you know, so having conversations with people that are doing good work, like I said, you know, good people doing good work, like I said at the top, that kind of thing, that's the best way, by far and away the best way to get to learn.
Yeah, and actually, you know, I keep mentioning that, you know, on the podcast, we speak to a few leaders, etc. But people's feedback has been really interesting when they've come on the show. They've often said that it's been quite a cathartic experience because they've had to think about things they've not thought about for a long time.
That's a really interesting point. One of the things that I recommend to people is being intentional about their leadership. So, you know, programmers are intentional about their ability to program in JavaScript or whatever it might be, right? You know, Java, who knows what. I'm currently trying to teach myself badly, but I'm trying to teach myself Elixir, and I'm intentional about it, right? I'm doing work on it. But people think leadership is just a thing that you do in the moment, right? And you have to be intentional about it. So I keep like quite a lot of notes. Like the reason that I mean, you can see I'm sort of reading from some notes here. I did some prep for this call, but I pulled some stuff together from blog posts and other stuff because I've got, it's a little bit ropey and a bit ad hoc in places, but I've got a relatively, you know, robust set of thinking about how I think about leadership. And I encourage other people to do the same thing. And it starts with just taking some notes, right? Writing a blog post every now and again, keeping track of what you're doing. You know, that sort of stuff, I think it really helps.
Yeah, and this kind of leads us on quite nicely onto the next question that I want to bring up, which is just, do you think as time's gone on, has your leadership style changed at all?
Yes. So style, this question of style comes up a lot in tech. And I don't know, I haven't really worked outside of tech too much, but so I don't know whether it's more or less common in engineering than it is with other disciplines, but a lot of engineers have a very well-developed sense of how they like to be managed. And so I think, you know, you hear engineers saying, oh, don't micromanage me. I need to do, you know, we mentioned that before. And so I think it's quite important for a leader to be conscious of their style. Okay. And so the best, I had this pointed out to me, this framework pointed out to me before. I don't mind the framework every now and again. You know, they're not the be all and end all, but it's good to have a framework. But there's this fantastic framework called situational leadership, which was from Hershey and Blanchard. I think they did it in the 70s or 80s, right? It's actually quite old, but it's really simple. And if you can imagine a 2x2 grid, you've got this sort of directive behavior on the x-axis from low to high, and then you've got supportive behavior from low to high on the y-axis. Okay. And give four boxes: directing, coaching, supporting, and delegating. Okay, so high directive and low supportive is just directing, right? That's telling people what to do. Okay, you know, high directive about high supportive is coaching. So it's like the top right box. Okay, so bottom right directing, top right coaching, top left supporting, bottom left delegating, right? And there's this idea that you sort of swoop through the four types, right? Okay. So you want to try and move someone, if you can, or a team, from just directly telling them what to do, you know, through coaching, then supporting and participating with them, and then delegating, empowering, right? And, you know, the idea that sort of empowered, a delegated, empowered team is the most effective, right? So I've found this very useful. And to answer your question, has my leadership style changed? Absolutely. I used to just go like 100% from directing to delegating with nothing in the middle. All right. So I'd tell people what to do and assume that they knew. I'd just tell them what to do, and then I would go and do my thing. Or I would just delegate, which is, you know, sort of similar, and stand back, assuming like they demonstrate competence in some dimension. I go, okay, they must be competent everywhere. Off you go. And then what happened was, if you tell people what to do, you're a micromanager and people don't like it. But if you delegate without a narrative, then people lose the why. Okay. And they get lost. They get lost in the journey, right? And so I had to learn, and I've learned this the hard way over the last sort of 5-10 years, this sort of coaching selling quadrant and the supporting participating quadrant are really, really important, you know, and you can't get to delegating and empowering from directing and telling unless you go through those other two quadrants as well. So I don't know if I've got it right yet. I think, you know, so actually one of the big lessons from this framework, the thing that really stands out, is if you ask someone their leadership style and they tell you I'm X, that's a red flag.
Right.
Because the X depends on who am I talking to, what's the task, you know, how mature are they, how well have they worked together, you know, there's a ton of you know, interpersonal relationships, all of these things, there's like five or six different factors that might come into it. And so what works? So directing and telling may be absolutely appropriate if I'm in a particular context, but be completely inappropriate in another context, right? And so the idea that there is just one style, I think, is a bit of a red flag, right? And you want to be able to go through the different kinds and pick the right one. You know, like I said, have I got it right? You know, maybe not. But at least the lesson for me is that there isn't a one style.
Yeah, it's amazing because it just makes you realize how much, you know, actual thought and goes into leadership. I mean, before I started doing these podcasts, I presumed that leadership was just, you've got really good at your role. The next step is to manage a team of people doing that role. But yeah, it's so much more than that, isn't it? It goes way, way, way beyond that. It's a huge, huge skill on its own.
I saw this quote the other day, and I wish I'd said it because it's brilliant. But I honestly did a bit of a hunt, and I can't find who originally said it. But I'll repeat it here now. Management is not a promotion; it's a career change.
Yeah,
right. And so this idea of individual contributors being promoted to management is a bit of a fallacy, and we need to sort of kill it if we can. And then I'll go on to say that management to leadership, because I think they're quite different things, is another career change.
Yeah,
and so, you know, if you ask me, has my style changed over time? Absolutely, right? You know, I've had two career changes. I was an individual contributor, and then I got sort of management jobs, and that was actually a career change, and it's a completely different style. And then, and you know, more recently getting into sort of senior leadership positions, completely different style needed again. And you know, so you know, and the tricky thing is for new people is you have these boundary conditions, right? You know, in your career, you tend to sort of go along, and then all of a sudden you get there's a discontinuity, right? And these boundary conditions. And the frustrating thing, I've seen this with the engineers and I've seen it myself, the frustrating thing is that at the point where you get promoted, like day one of the new job, whatever that job is when you're least qualified to do it, right? And it's interesting because you've got there presumably because you're really good at the thing you were doing before, right? And now you have to reprove yourself for the thing you're doing now, right? And that discontinuity, really, boundary condition really, really trips people up a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. I mean, have you ever worked under bad management before? You don't have to name any names here, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, look, I'm sure some of my management would be considered bad management over the years, but yeah, definitely. And I got an MBA in 2000 or so. Well, I think I finished in 2004, and the reason I started an MBA was because I was sick and tired of being badly managed.
Yeah.
And one thing was interesting. One thing I've noticed, like one of the really big differences between Oz and the UK in tech is that Australia's full of really good engineers. Right. So we're really good doers. You know, we know how to do stuff and we, you know, get in and do it. But the quality of management in Australia isn't as good as here in the UK. And then interestingly, in the UK, engineering is really good as well, right? Like the quality of engineers here in London is about as good as I've seen. But you get this extra level of management where the management and leadership here and in particular some of the selling side of the business that happens over here in the UK is just so much better than Australia. The reason of the MBA was I wanted to be able to talk the language of management and leadership to people who I thought weren't very good at their jobs, right? Because I knew they weren't going to come to me with my language, so I needed to go to them with their language.
Right.
And that's why I did the MBA. I had a few jobs in the 90s. I would argue I had pretty poor management.
Yeah, I think everyone has really, but isn't it interesting that bad management is so easy to see?
Yeah. Yeah. There's one of the things with management and leadership is that, you know, if you watch a game of rugby, I think it's probably more true in rugby union than football, but the same thing applies. But if you watch a game of rugby union and the referee is brilliant, then you don't know his name.
Yeah.
Right? Because he disappears, right? And the game flows and everything happens and complaining. But when a referee is really bad, everyone's shouting the name of the referee and complaining about it, right? And so I call it the good referee paradox, right? The
best that's excellent.
Yeah, no one knows the name of the best referee. and the little bit is true of management. Like there are folks who need to stand on the hood and be the ornament and take all the plaudits, but I don't consider them necessary to be the best managers or leaders. The best managers or leaders stand at the back of the room and let their team take all the credit, right? And the people who really know what's going on, right, know that success wasn't just accidental, right? That it was engineered, right, by good leadership. And you know, they're the kind of people you want to work with, the people who can do that, but also the people that recognize that's what's happened.
Yeah. Well, wow. This has been so fascinating, Matthew. I genuinely could chat. There's so much we could talk about, honestly. This is, we've literally, We've literally just scraped the surface with this. We could carry on for hours, I'm sure. But I think for one final question, more about you this time, Matthew. As a leader, what's been your greatest achievement in your career, would you say?
Okay, so I had been thinking about this, and I've got three things. I'll go very quickly over it. So from about 2000 to 2005, I built a payment switch, I was on a team that built a payment switch from scratch, like a card scheme payment switch from scratch in Java. And back then, building stuff at mission critical high performance in Java was not the done thing, and trying to sell that kind of thing to banks and whatnot was not the done thing. And the highs of that was, it was probably the highest density of A-list engineers that I've ever worked with. It was about 5-6. Really, really, really incredible team, like really, really incredible team. We were solving a problem that everyone said was impossible, and we solved it, right? But on the low side, it was some of the most insane hours I've ever worked in my life, like to this day, 68 hour weeks, all night, multiple times, that's just crazy stuff, right? And then we had a big period of growth followed by a sharp cull because of some commercial failures with a client. And it was really, really tough. That was the first time I'd ever had to I'm going to have to let you go conversation with people. And that was, I don't know what the opposite of life affirming is, but it was that, right? It was like, this is the worst I've ever felt in my life, short of family issues, right? So that was tough. And then the last low was actually, it was a less than favorable financial outcome for the early stage employees. I managed to turn, I'm not talking out of school here, but I managed to turn an investment of my own money of about 30 grand into 30 Australian dollars. And back then at the time, that was a lot of money for me to lose. So it was an amazing sort of, career lesson. not a great financial one. The other thing I'll just quickly touch on. So Coop, I was lucky enough to be CTO of Coop in Berlin, which is the electric scooter sharing scheme down in Berlin. That was one of my first ventures here with DV, and it was brilliant. Working with brilliant people. The highlight there was just, it was an incredible project. We built an Ocean mobility platform in 9 months, right? Just incredible. Jesus. But the low lights was, I actually burned a few of the team out, and I didn't realize it. And I didn't realize one of them was actually really seriously burned out until quite some time later. So that really weighed heavily on me. But and just the final one, like my proudest achievement to date really is DV London, the engineering team there. I've taken that, or I've been involved in taking that from 3 engineers in 2016 up to about 25 or so now. And, we go up and down. Sometimes we've had as many as 30 or 40 extra, or not 30, say 20 or 30 extra engineers, contractors and stuff working on different ventures. We've built 30 odd different ventures here in London that I've been involved with. It's been brilliant. And I couldn't be prouder that the culture, the team, the people that we have there, they're some of the best people I've ever worked with in my life. So I'm super proud to have been lucky enough to do that.
Amazing, Matthew. Look, like I said before, we really could sit here all day and I could chat to you all afternoon. But I'm very aware you're a very busy man, so I'll have to let you go for now. But, I'm sure a lot of listeners, leaders, managers, engineers will be able to take a few leaves out of your book. It's been unbelievably interesting for me to chat to you. So, thank you once again for taking the time to do it.
Okay. Look, just one final comment. So if you want to get in contact with me, I love chatting to people. I'm more than happy. Sure. MatthewSinclair.com is a good place to start. I've got some blog posts on there. I bloviate on Twitter. I normally use Twitter for just sort of like non-work related stuff. So it's just @MatthewSinclair. Or if you want to go old school, send me an email. hello@MatthewSinclair.com.
Excellent. For now, thank you.
Thanks, mate. Thank you. Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favorite streaming platform.